this morning, 24-1022, Culp v. Remington & Montrose Golf Club.
May it please the court. My name is Damon Davis, and I represent the plaintiffs, Ms. Culp and Ms. Peters. Plaintiffs raised four issues on appeal, but the two I would like to concentrate on today are the conflicting verdicts with respect to Ms. Culp and the exotic dancer evidence with respect to Ms. Peters. Of course, I'm happy to answer questions on any of the issues. First, with regard to the conflicting verdicts, this court should either order a new trial or enforcement of the punitive damages verdict. And on this issue, I'd like to address three main points. One, the application of the Supreme Court's opinion in Dietz. Two, how the answer to verdict question five is a finding of liability. And three, how question five can potentially be reconciled with questions one and three. First, though plaintiff's preferred outcome is obviously enforcement of the punitive damages verdict that already exists, perhaps the most straightforward way to resolve this case is to apply the Supreme Court's Dietz decision and order a new trial. This court, the Tenth Circuit, has previously ruled that a special verdict cannot be returned to the jury for further deliberation.
Counsel, can I stop you there?
Yes.
I know that the verdict form was labeled a special verdict form, that the parties both call it that. But let's say I have a hang up on that. Help me understand why this is a special and not a general verdict.
Well, I think everybody below has agreed that it's a special verdict form. I think in particular with Ms. Culp, you have specific findings as to each claim, and then you also have the separate finding as to punitive damages, which contains separate findings within it. And so I think you have to look at the answers to all of those in order to reach the determination.
Well, but in Johnson, this court has said that a general verdict is one where it's simply the jury declares the winner and they say how much. Isn't that exactly what this verdict form required the jury to do? They won, determined liability, and then if they found it, they said, here are the damages.
Perhaps with respect to Ms. Peters, with Ms. Culp, you did have that extra question with regard to punitive damages, which has separate findings, which amount to liability, but it was a separate question from the first two questions. But I think even if it's a general verdict, you still have the same issue of conflicting verdicts that would need to be reconciled, and you would still have the issue that should have been sent back to the jury for further consideration to reconcile these findings.
Well, sure, but it seems to me that as a threshold question, it matters whether it's a special or general verdict because, as you know, we're talking about different subparagraphs of a rule, and one of them requires a contemporaneous objection to say, here's what we're asking the district court to do, and the other does not. So if it's a general verdict, has Ms. Culp in particular waived her argument about now asking us to order a new trial because at the trial level, she didn't say to the district court, here's what here's our objection and here's what we're asking you to do.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First, I think, one, since the defense has agreed that this is a special verdict, I think they would have, and has always argued it as such, I think that would have waived that issue. That it is a general verdict and would require an objection, and two plaintiffs did object. And if you look up, both counsel stood up and asked for the court's attention. Defense counsel asked to approach. Both attorneys went up. Defense counsel spoke first. At that point, the judge said, yes, we're gonna resolve this after I dismissed the jury. Plaintiff's counsel then spoke up and said, hey, I don't think the jury can do this. The court said, before he could finish his statement, the court said, I agree, I'm gonna resolve it after I send it back to the jury. And the court said later in its order on the jury verdict that I understood that counsel was objecting to this being an inconsistent verdict. So the court knew what plaintiff's counsel was getting at and had already made up her mind to resolve this after the jury was sent back. So I think that is adequate to preserve it because the trial court understood what plaintiff's counsel was getting at the time. And so either way, this should have gone back to the jury. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Dietz, it can go back whether it's a general verdict or a special verdict. Dietz confirmed that the trial court not only has inherent authority to resubmit the issue back to the jury, but also has authority under Rule 51b3. Now, this court has previously said it doesn't exist under Rule 49a, but this is a separate rule, 51b3, that this court has never spoken on, and now the Supreme Court has said a specific verdict can go back under that rule. And it should have done that here, but probably the court's discretion was circumscribed because this court has previously said it can't do that, and it has never confirmed that Dietz overrules those prior decisions on Rule 49A. And so this would be an appropriate decision case to clarify that and give guidance to the court on sending it back.
Dietz doesn't really overrule it. It doesn't say you misinterpreted the rules. It just says even if the rules don't allow it, you'd have inherent power to do it.
Well, you do, yeah. It doesn't directly contradict this court's interpretation of 49A, but it does say you can do it under Rule 51B. Right. So the effect is you can send it back despite what's been said
right,
before.
Right.
Yeah, so it doesn't directly overrule. And that's probably one of the things that would hold the district court back from doing precisely that, is it didn't directly overturn or contradict this court's prior rulings.
Well, did you have any other claims other than a hostile work environment based on her sex or retaliated against her for reporting unlawful sexual harassment? Do you have any other claims in your complaint?
There was also a claim for negligent hiring and supervision. There was no punitive damages for that, so this issue on the inconsistent verdicts does not affect the claim for negligent hiring or supervision.
Well, I guess my question is, you can't disagree that if they said no to question one and no to question two, that it was just an oversight or a mistake on plugging in $125,000 in punitive damages.
I think the jury did do it deliberately, and I think that gets into my second point, that the question five that they answered in order to give punitive damages is effectively a finding of liability, because they answer yes to question five in order.
But you can't have liability if they answered no to both of those questions.
But that gives you an inconsistent verdict, because you can't ignore question five just because they
said
no.
And that's why the court said that surplusage and it's a mistake, and I'm just going to excise it.
But you, under this court's precedent, and I think under the common law, you can't just ignore a finding of fact. This court said in the Bonin case, if you were to ignore a jury finding, that would treat the prior, and specific verdict, that would treat the prior two questions as a general verdict. And here, everybody agreed that this was a specific verdict, and you would be treating those prior questions as general verdicts, which wasn't the intent when the verdict form was submitted. And additionally, the traditional remedy, if the jury is not following instructions, is you either re-instruct them and tell them to do it correctly, or you order a new trial or a mistrial. You don't just throw out part of what they did. You have to consider it all. And if you can't correct it through a new instruction, you have to order a new trial. And that's been the traditional remedy. That's what the Seventh Circuit said in the Freeman case. And that's what this court said in the Bonnet case. You don't just ignore something the jury did. And so then you have to dig into the language of the findings. And they found specifically that in order to answer question five, you would have to find that Ms. Culp was sexually harassed or retaliated against, that this was intentional discrimination, and it was done in violation of her rights, all as defined in verdict form 38. 38 makes clear, and assuming the jury followed the jury instructions, which we do, 38 makes clear that the rights in question are her rights under federal law. It specifically refers to her rights under federal law. Instruction one states that federal law is Title VII. It specifically says the court in this case is instructing you on Title VII. This is a Title VII claim for sexual harassment or retaliation. And then the court wraps up with question 42 saying, you, the jury, can only consider the law given to you by this court. So assuming the jury followed the instructions, the only law they can apply to find her rights were violated is Title VII.
Counsel, can I understand, are you arguing in the alternative, meaning your first view would be these jury, the jury verdict is actually, you can reconcile it and that we should just order that the punitive damages award be enforced? That's your starting point. Your fallback position is, well, they are inconsistent, so we should order a new trial. Do I have that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. I think the reconciliation is separate from whether they conflict. The first question is, do they conflict? Our position is clearly they do. That at a minimum requires a new trial. If it is, and if this is a finding of fact, which it, of liability, which again, when you look at a specific verdict, you look at the jury's individual findings, apply the law to it, and then determine if that establishes liability. And doing that with question five establishes liability because they had to find that there was sexual harassment, that Ms. Culp was sexually harassed or retaliated against intentionally in violation of Title VII, and that this was not only intentional, but with malice and reckless indifference, because Title VII is the only law that the jury was allowed to apply to determine her rights were violated. And if you apply the law to that, that's a finding of liability, and that's precisely what you do with the special verdict. Now, the reconciliation raises a question of how confusing is Instruction 44? Because it really hinges on how do you read Instruction 44. 44 was the instruction that told the jury, if you find for plaintiff on multiple claims, you can only award damages once for the same damages. That is based on a Colorado state form instruction. The form instruction comments itself warn, this is a confusing instruction. And without clarification, it confused the jury, and it could potentially confuse the jury to only award damages on one claim.
And the plaintiffs objected to that instruction, as I recall.
We did object to that instruction, and we said you can resolve this issue through the verdict form and trying to instruct the jury to only award damages once there. And so we objected to it. And the issue is if the jury believed they could only award damages once, that's going to encourage them to pick one claim. And we submit that they picked the punitive damages claim because they thought there was malice and willful conduct, so that one fit the best. And if that's what the jury did, then these claims can be reconciled on that basis.
Let me ask, with respect to the remedy, if we accept your primary argument, which this, these are in conflict, if we accept that argument, there are two verdicts then that aren't affected. Is that what you're saying? So your only arguments on those two issues would be your evidentiary arguments.
Yes, that is correct.
And what are the two that would still remain?
The two would, well, actually it would only be the, at that point it would only be the negligent hire and supervision, because I think we'd have a resolution of the other two claims of the sexual harassment and retaliation. The damages would be the punitive damages for those claims.
So there'd only be one claim that would not be retried?
Yes.
Assuming that you lose on the evidentiary issue.
Assuming that we lose on the evidentiary issue, yes, Your Honor.
And on the summary judgment, what was that? What was the
that was here? That was for Ms. Peters, and our argument there was that she was retaliated against, and the retaliation was in the form of the defendant did not take her allegations seriously. In fact, when she complained, they told her, you know, a lot of people like this guy. Are you sure you want to complain about him?
But and the then, retaliation was making her work with him.
And make him work with him afterward. Yes, that was the alleged retaliation for the summary judgment claim. And we think there's no circuit authority one way or the other on it. The district courts go both ways, but we believe the more persuasive cases say it can be when you force the person to work in close contact with the alleged harassment.
Can you help me understand the timing, though? Wasn't Ms. Culp first made the allegations against the bartender, and when they interviewed Ms. Peters, and she did not raise her own allegations at that time. So was the golf club on notice when they scheduled them to work together that Ms. Peters had made specific allegations against him?
There's a conflict in the evidence there. Ms. Peters testified that she did make allegations against him at that point, but she didn't have time to put them in the written form that she gave to the golf club because they asked her to fill it out in the middle of her shift and she had customers waiting on her, but she testified that she made her own complaints. So on summary judgment, you have to accept the plaintiff's version, and so she did. And With that, I'm out of time. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gower.
May it please the court, Nicholas Gower, attorney for the appellee defendant Remington and Montrose Golf Club. After a five-day trial, the jury returned its verdict in favor of Remington on all of the appellants, Ms. Culp and Ms. Peters, claims for relief. Despite rejecting Ms. Culp's Title VII claims for hostile work environment and retaliation, the jury nevertheless attempted to award her punitive damages. Because punitive damages are clearly not available to an unsuccessful Title VII plaintiff like Ms. Culp, the district court ultimately set aside the improper punitive damages award against that was entered against Remington.
These are inconsistent verdicts and suggest that the jury was confused.
I think they can be reconciled. There's obviously an apparent inconsistency that's created anytime juries don't.
Not an apparent inconsistency. It's an inconsistency.
Well, when juries don't follow instructions and
you wonder which instruction did they not follow? Did they not follow the instruction that said award damages, award compensatory damages, or did it misunderstand that if it didn't award compensatory damages, it could still award punitives? What, isn't this a classic example when you'd want to tell the jury, this doesn't look right, go back and reread the instructions, and I'll reread the instructions, and you come back with something that makes sense? Wouldn't you want that?
Well, I think the appellants could have done that. Alternatively,
well, our precedent, assuming it's a special verdict, our precedent said that that couldn't have happened. The judge didn't have the authority to do that.
Well, I think that's a question ultimately. Dietz does not get to it, as you point out. All it held was that the district court had the inherent authority to do that.
Yeah, I think under Dietz now this situation should not occur again. A judge will know I can call the jury back and do that. So hopefully after this case it won't be an issue. But you can't blame an attorney or a judge from following precedent, I don't think.
Well, I wouldn't blame Judge Rodriguez for how she handled it. And to get to Judge Federico's question regarding general versus special, I think if this were to be construed, the parties obviously treated it as a special verdict. The court in her subsequent order kind of maybe touched upon the issue with respect to, well, under case law, if it's a general verdict, our authority says we should reconcile them. If it's a general verdict with special interrogatories, we should still be reconciling them. But alternatively, if this is a Rule 59E could be employed to address a general verdict because punitive damages are not available.
Let me ask you, do you think, I'm just trying to sort of piece together the jury instructions with the verdict form. Do you see the verdict form as being part of the instructions?
No.
Why not?
Well, I just think they're separate.
Well, sure. I mean, they're separate documents. But when the court is saying, here's the law that I want you to apply, and here is a form in which you're going to document your findings that contains within the form substantive directions, why isn't that part of the instructions?
Well, I suppose it depends on how broadly you define the instructions, but the
verdict, that's what I'm trying to get at.
I would treat them differently based on, I mean, they had the separate instructions. All the instructions were read to the jury. I don't think there's intended to be necessarily all one big comprehensive document. The jury is focused on the verdict form. To the extent they have questions, they can refer back to the instructions, but ultimately it's the verdict form. And to get to kind of the overall reconciliation and how this could have happened, there's at least two bases for reconciling this verdict that doesn't necessitate a new trial. I think this court could not do the appellant's requested relief of entering a judgment in favor of Ms. Culp for $125,000. That would plainly violate the express findings of no liability for hostile work environment under Title VII, as well as the retaliation claim under number three. And I think this court, reconciling these verdicts is possible. And I think one thing that's important is, and it's mentioned in the briefs, you know, confusion regarding only answer question number five regarding punitive damages if you answered yes to questions one or three. That, I think, is clear. It's referenced in the reply brief, I believe, page six, that the jury followed the verdict form in all other regards. That's not correct, because with respect to Ms. Culp's verdict form, the jury answered no on her hostile work environment claim. And immediately following that instruction, or that verdict, the instruction said, do not answer questions two or three, three being the punitive damages question, if you answered no.
Do you view this as a case of jury confusion or jury disobedience?
We would view this as a case of jury disobedience on the basis of Remington was not perfect in this case. There was a lot of evidence of all the things Remington could have done better. And we would view that the jury was trying to send Remington a message to do better.
So you think the jury went back in the deliberation room, read the instructions, read the verdict form, and was not confused at all when it looked at the directions the verdict form gave, when it looked at instruction 38 that did not tie the punitive damages at all to any prior claims directly, when it looked at instruction, I believe, 44 that said you can only award damages once. They looked at all that, understood it properly, and said, you know what, even though the judge told us this is what we're supposed to do and this is the law, we're going to just disregard it because we want to punish Remington. That's your position?
Well, that's essentially what the verdict form asked, was how much do you want to punish Remington? And they answered the question.
But I guess I'm getting at, as we're looking at reconciliation, I'm trying to determine if the first instance, whether the jury was even properly instructed or they were led down a path of confusion that then gets to this verdict form that's, you know, difficult to reconcile. And I'm just trying to figure out sort of how to think about those instructions as they relate to the verdict form.
Well, I would note that the verdict forms were prepared by appellants. So they're the ones who submitted them. There might have been minor revisions, but substantively, it's what the plaintiffs.
Yeah, but the court submitted. Owns the verdict form the same way the court owns the instructions. I mean, the parties submit draft instructions, but, you know, ultimately it's the court's duty to instruct the jury upon the proper law that they apply. And this is why I was asking you about, is the verdict form part of that? Because, it's common practice that parties submit verdict forms, instructions, but ultimately it's the court's duty to instruct the jury in the law. I mean, you agree with that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Can we go to some of the other issues? Yeah. Do you have anything?
I don't, no.
Let me ask you about the summary judgment.
Sure.
Against Ms. Peters. She engaged in protected activity. You don't dispute that.
We did not dispute that for purposes of summary judgment.
Okay. So the issue is whether the response to her protected activity was sufficiently harsh to constitute retaliation. Is that correct? Was there anything else involved in the granting of summary judgment?
You're correct, Your Honor. Remington understood the argument as this wine dispute that happened based on the allegations, that was the basis for the retaliation claim with respect to Ms. Peters. And Remington obviously disputes what Ms. Peters reported during its investigation.
But if she's reported on her on the bartender, and then when she after that is resolved and he comes back to work, the bartender comes back to work, her schedule puts her working with him. She says he's not filling my orders, and I don't want to deal with that. He's retaliating against me, at least. And the boss says, oh, quit complaining. So she quits. Don't you think requiring her to work for somebody who she's reported would sufficiently deter people from reporting misconduct? That that it rises to the level of retaliation?
Well, I think you have to focus continuing to work with the person that you made a complaint about, assuming she did. That would go more towards a hostile work environment claim.
Well, just are the elements of retaliation satisfied? Why aren't they? I thought the judge's view was this is not sufficient to constitute retaliation. It's not harsh enough. It didn't affect her enough. But the test is whether it would deter someone from reporting, from engaging in protected activity. And if she's forced to work with someone who won't fill her orders, and the response by the employer is, oh, suck it up, then why is that not sufficient to rise to the necessary level?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that this court should follow its sister circuits of the Second and the Fourth, that inaction does not support a retaliation claim. Retaliatory conduct is based on action, not inaction. So under its Fincher, the Second Court's decision, the court went on to explain that it leaves the employee no worse off if the employer conducts either an inadequate investigation or fails to take action. The employee is no worse off than had they never made the complaint in the first place. And I think that rationale should be followed by this court as well.
Let me ask you about an evidentiary issue.
Sure.
I'll get this straight. So part of the evidence introduced, it was the second issue, not the emotional distress issue, but the other one.
Exotic danger.
That's part of the emotional distress issue. I'm sorry. Can you recall what the second evidentiary issue was? Because it was offered to show that the culps, whoever the Feelys, had conducted an adequate investigation.
Yeah.
Over her complaining at her prior employer when she worked at Applebee's.
Yes, Your Honor.
And how was that evidence relevant? It was offered, as I understand it, because it would show that the Feelys did an adequate investigation, but there was no evidence that the Feelys were ever told about this, as I recall.
Your Honor, with respect to Joelle Ricaldi's testimony, and I think in the briefing they represent it wasn't relayed to the Feelys. In our brief, we cite she did also tell the Feelys in the investigation about her experience.
Yeah, but was that elicited at a trial that she had told the Feelys?
Yes.
During trial, it was pointed out.
Yes.
And that's contrary to what the plaintiffs had argued.
Yes. It was after her initial answer where she discussed what she claimed she told the Feelys, or at least Mr. Crippen and Eric Feely, regarding her experience at Applebee's. And later on in the testimony, and we cite the testimony in our brief, where she also confirms that she told the Feelys that information in the investigation. Plus, there was Trial Exhibit 80, the page regarding Mrs. Feely's handwritten notes substantively the same, and that exhibit was admitted, but substantively the same information is contained within that exhibit as well. I see my time is up, so of course we would ask that this court affirm the district court judgments in full and this case, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Plaintiff's counsel have any remaining time? No? Okay. Thank you. Case is submitted. Counsel excused. We'll